morning, the committee will come to order. I'm wondering, Representative Swales, if you would be so kind as to move our minutes from February 26th minutes.
They look absolutely perfect, Mr. Chair. I move them.
Wonderful. Representative Swales moves the minutes of the February 26th meeting. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, we have a lot of work to get through. We're going to pick up where we left off last week with the with Representative Slocum's charter school accountability and oversight reform bill. We have at least a dozen amendments that are possibly going to be offered, and so we want to try to get through those. It is my intention to recess us at 10 if we're not done with those amendments, and then reconvene at 6 p.m. this evening so we can finish the amendments, and then it will be my intention to come back regularly scheduled time tomorrow morning to take any public testimony on the bill and then vote on the bill at that time. So obviously, members, I'm going to be pushing and trying to keep us going as quickly as possible, but we also want to make sure we know what we're doing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
As the author of a couple of those amendments, just a process thought, you know, if everybody doesn't talk on every one, it might help.
I'm sorry.
I mean, if there's something people need to say, but somebody already said what they would have said, it might help them move through.
Wonderful.
It might actually get done today.
Wonderful advice, Representative Abler. Wonderful advice. We are still going to walk through the remaining parts of the bill. We're about two-thirds of the way through the bill. We've actually, as I read the bill, kind of bit off of most of the chunkier pieces already. There are still some pieces, major pieces left in regards to author fees. There are a number of lease aid issues that, quite frankly, members might be better, more fully vetted in our finance committee. All that by way of saying that I want to try to get through the last third of the bill as quickly as possible and then get us on to our amendments, because I think in our amendments we'll have the discussions that I think many of you want to have in debating the amendments relative to major provisions in the bill. If I recall, we were on page 10 of the DE5 amendment, delete all amendments, when we left off last week. And so, Representative Slocum, good morning.
Good morning. Let's get going.
Sounds good. Representative Slocum, I think we had just done the audit report. Is that correct? That's that?
I can believe so.
Okay. So, remind me where we're at. I'm thinking subdivision 7 on page 10.
That's exactly right.
Page very well. Please proceed, and Ms. Larson, you've been helping us in terms of just identifying the pieces as we walk through here.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document 80935DE5, page 10, beginning on line 23, you see subdivision 7 there. It clarifies language that has always existed in this law, and it states that a charter school is exempt from all statutes and rules that would otherwise apply to a school, school board, or school district unless a statute or rule elsewhere in the education code is made specifically applicable to that charter school or is included in this section. Just as an aside, from time to time we've adopted legislation of one sort or another outside of this section, and we haven't always been consistent about indicating whether the intent is to have it apply to charter schools or not. And this makes clear exactly what the parameters of application would be. Subdivision 8, beginning on line 30 of page 10, lists the state and local requirements that are applicable to charter schools. Many of the items here have been items of long standing. Some of them are clarifications. For example, on 10.33, there is language to say that the educational accountability provisions governing standards and assessments applicable to school districts also apply to charter schools. That is clarification of previously existing language. On page 11, beginning on line 7, this is consistent with law governing school districts generally. It requires that a charter school student be released for religious instruction, consistent with language we have for release time elsewhere in the statute. On page 11, line 15, there is language clarifying that a charter school may not charge tuition to resident students of Minnesota. On page 11, line 35, there is language pertaining to data, among other provisions. And also, clarification about employment. There is on page 12, beginning on line 4, permission to the commissioner, allowing the commissioner to reduce the charter school's state aid if the charter school fails to correct certain violations. On page 12, line 7, there's a clarification about the amount of financial penalty that the commissioner may exact in such circumstances. On page 12, beginning on line 10, subdivision 9, it has to do with admissions parameters for charter schools, language governing the limiting of admission in certain circumstances, specifically to residents of a specific geographical area where the percentage of the population of non-Caucasian people is greater than the percent in the congressional district. That parameter is gone, so a charter school would not be able to admit admission on that basis. Also, language saying that if the charter school is the only school located in a town serving pupils within a particular grade, then the residents of the town must be given preference for enrollment. That is stricken also. There's clarification of a previously existing direction to the charter school to develop and publish a lottery policy and process to be used when accepting pupils by lot. This is when enrollment exceeds program capacity. Then there is a new language which had been proposed before, but until my understanding is the No Child Left Behind law was amended, it was not permissible. Now it is, and that is to give preference to enrolling children of charter school employees. And then there is just language on 12.31 and 32 indicating the intent that a charter school must not establish any criteria or requirements for admission that are inconsistent with this subdivision on admissions requirements. Subdivision 10, beginning at the bottom of page 12 and on to page 13, just has technical changes. On subdivision 11 on page 13, there is language indicating that that a charter school board is subject to the whistleblowing provision in chapter 181, and there is a requirement that when a charter school offers employment to a prospective employee, that charter school must give that employee a written description of the terms and conditions of employment and also information about the school's policies. The next two subdivisions are unamended. Subdivision 14 having to do with annual reports. There is a requirement that the charter school publish an annual report approved by the charter board. It states the minimum content for that report and also directs the distribution of the information.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vanier, my hope is to get us through the bill, and then we'll come back to questions.
So okay.
I've got you on the list.
My apologies.
No, quite all right. Thank you. Ms. Fleisch, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, subdivision 15 at the bottom of page 13 and on to page 14 establishes the process by which the commissioner reviews and comments upon the performance of an authorizer, how well the authorizer's performance evaluation functions. This review would occur on a five-year basis. This is to ensure that the authorizers are maintaining a level of performance consistent with the intent of the law. There is a requirement that before a charter contract can be renewed, the authorizer has to provide the commissioner with a written evaluation of a school's performance. Then paragraph B has to do with the fee, and C and D actually have to do with the fee that a authorizer may charge a charter school for the duties prescribed to the authorizer under this law.
Well, Ms. Larson, that'll be the subject of an author's amendment, I believe, coming up soon. So we don't need to get into it. At this point, we'll do that when we get into the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, Subdivision 16 on transportation is unamended. Subdivision 17 is somewhat amended. It allows the charter school to lease space, or clarifies that a charter school may lease space from an independent school board that may be an authorizer, public organization, a private property owner, or a sectarian organization if the leased space is constructed as a school facility. These entities leased were potential entities to provide leases, but under slightly different language. There is also new language on page 15, paragraph B, allowing, with the approval of an authorizer, to form a separate affiliated nonprofit building company to provide the school facility. That authorizer is directed to submit a supplemental affidavit to the commissioner regarding the due diligence that the authorizer has performed in this circumstance.
And members, this goes beyond the auditor's recommendations, and this was also recommended by the auditor's report 5 years ago.
Thank you. Ms. Bush?
Mr. Chairman, members, on page 16, you'll see that subdivision 18 has been stricken. This does not work in terms of the timing of authorizing and chartering schools, and for that reason has been stricken. On subdivision 19, on page 16, line 11, there is it's all technical. It has to do with charters, with disseminating information to interested individuals regarding charter schools. On page 16, line 17, subdivision 20, this is clarification about when notice has to be given for teachers to seek leave to teach in a charter school or to return to their school district. There's also language clarifying the relationship of the teacher on leave and the obligations with respect to payment of TRA. On subdivision 21, 22, there are either no changes or technical changes where you see sponsors being authorized. On page 17, line 12, subdivision 23, there is some clarification about the timing of the process for notice when a charter school contract will not be renewed or will be terminated. And clarification about the process under which that event occurred. There's also clarification about a voluntary process to mutually terminate the contract. There's also language clarifying when the commissioner may terminate an existing contract between an authorizer and charter school. It's on page 18. The specific grounds are on lines 21 and following. On page 18, line 28, subdivision 23, related party lease costs. This is to clarify what would constitute a conflict of interest and therefore be prohibited. There are definitions of related party, affiliate, immediate family, person, and control. On page 19, line 24, subdivision 25, there is clarification about the legal authority with respect to the charter school board of directors, their requirements to provide information about insurance policies and so forth. You'll see that on subdivision 26, right at the bottom of page 19, a lot of language is stricken. That's because it appears in subdivision 23A. And, Mr. Chairman, members, on page 20, section 2, beginning on line 13, this amends 124D11, which is the language governing the financing of charter schools. There's language about payments when a charter school has ceased to operate and what amounts are due and so forth. And on page 21, there's also clarification about what occurs if a charter school fails to comply with the commissioner's directive to return federal or state grant funds, or if in certain circumstances a charter school fails to pay either the state, a school district, an intermediate school district, or a service cooperative after it receives an undisputed invoice for goods and services. On page 21, section 3, that section is intended to revive and continue the Charter School Advisory Council. And section 4 makes clear that the effective date of this act is August 1 of 2009.
Very well. Thank you, Ms. Larson. We have three questions, I believe, from members, and then we're going to move on to amendments. Representative Norton, and then Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a number of questions. I'm not sure I can find them all now. Okay, on page 11, and I spoke with the charter school folks about this earlier this week, I'm aware of a situation, it's with regard to data and record keeping, of a situation where a charter school has lost all the records for students, including their grades and graduation, proof of graduation, and I'm wondering what we have put in place to safeguard students so that that information is no longer lost, and schools are not having to recreate bogus from memory type records for those students.
Representative Slocum.
I thought something might be in here and I didn't hear it.
Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, there is nothing that we put in here about that because charter schools by law are already required to maintain records. And I'm not sure what the penalty is if a school loses records.
I'm wondering if Mr. Morgan Brown from the department might help us with this. And Commissioner Anderson? Morning, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Kaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner. Members of the committee, Representative Norton, we would have to take a look at that. We believe under federal law there would be civil penalties for the school, but what we can do is call back and find out and probably have an answer for you before the end of the hearing, if that's all right.
Yes.
Representative Norton.
I'd appreciate that. I just, if the laws aren't tight enough or aren't being, there's a difference whether the laws are just not tight enough or whether they're being followed properly. And so if there is something in place that would require schools to somehow back up their information or file it with the state or something, I would feel better about that. But I know this situation has occurred. I don't ever want it to occur again. And just looking for security on that issue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Norton, the federal law is pretty stringent. In addition, the state aid is based on the students enrolled, and if the charter schools do not have student records, which has happened, then we actually have gone in and denied them state aid for not being able to produce those records and attendance records. So we've had situations like that, and we've dealt with them in the ways that we can deal with them.
And Mr. Chair, could I follow up? Because I found out about this kind of in an odd way, but I'm wondering what kind of transparency there is so that parents of these kids going to the charter school are aware that this has happened and know what to watch for in the future. How much transparency there's been about these incidents?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, actually under Chapter 13, if private data is even thought to have been released to the public, then the school is required to notify the parents of that release, even if that might be a possibility. So that's a requirement of all government agencies.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Peters.
Still had,
oh, I'm sorry, Representative Norton.
Do you want me to, well, I can wait, go through.
That's quite all right, go ahead.
Okay. I wondered on page 10, subdivision 7, with the exemption for rules and statutes, and I just realized, I understand this is rewritten language, but I'm wondering if you, if there's any attempt then by this body or somebody to then go through the rest of the statute book and decide which we feel are important enough for charter schools to have to adhere to if we're exempting them from all. Is there a process of review that we might go through or that the department or someone's going to go through?
Commissioner Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, that's a good question. This language is rewritten for that for a really specific reason. One is that over the course of the last couple of years, we've run in the case where we've tried to enforce rules that are written in the statute of charter schools but not specifically written in 124D10. And what some will say, what some attorneys are saying is that, well, that charter school is not subject to that rule unless it's written in 124D10. So what we're attempting to rewrite here is to say the charter school is subject to any rules in this statute and any other statute that the legislature might write in requiring charter schools to follow. So this sort of clarifies that. It's just because a rule and requirement is not specifically cross-referenced or written into 124D10 doesn't mean the charter school is not subject to that requirement.
So, Mr. Chair, if I understand this, moving forward, if there are any new statutes or old statutes that this body feels should be adhered to by all, including charter schools, we would have to be purposeful in putting that in statute in order for it to apply, if I'm understanding that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, that's the case today. But you do not have to, with this language, it would not have to be always written into 124D10. It could be written in another statute or rule, and the charter school would have to comply with that statute or rule.
Thank you.
Very good question. Any further questions, Representative Norton?
I did have one more if you'd entertain this. The other is on page 18, and I do have an amendment, but I'm assuming that'll come later, so I won't address that now. Page 18, line 21, and perhaps you addressed this and I just missed it, but it's a question I've been having from the very beginning, and that has to do with failure to meet pupil performance requirements contained in the contract. Can somebody explain to me how each school determines and each authorizer determines what the performance requirements are going to be for that particular school, and if they vary from school to school, and who makes the determination, or is it simply no child left behind, or...
Good question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, yes, each school negotiates with their authorizer their academic goals beyond what is required under AYP. So they can have goals beyond that. They also have goals with regard to their operations and their financial management, and all those are in the contract. So those things, if they do not fulfill those terms of the contract, that is grounds for terminating the charter.
Representative Fault has a follow-up question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is if a charter school doesn't meet AYP, which you said is also a requirement, or they don't meet the requirements of this on 18.21, how many years in a row can they not meet that before somebody pulls the plug on it?
Mr. Chair, Representative under AYP schools, there's a five-year process under AYP for all public schools, that there's different sanctions and so forth that go up every year, and so that applies to charter schools also.
Is it the same with this time?
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paul, that precedes what goes into the contract, because it's federal law, so they have to meet federal law, and this just provides additional terms in terms of academic achievement. Because, for example, if a school is a art school, there are no federal standards under AYP for achieving in terms of arts. so they would have their own goals and achievements in terms of art performances and so forth.
Representative Dabney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am on page 13, lines 24 through 32. The new language regarding public reports, it doesn't include any requirement that they make the report available to the public. And I'm wondering why not a requirement to make the report available to the public at large. These are public schools.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, on line 1332, it makes them public.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
Making them public and providing them to the public are different things. Why not a requirement that they make it available to the public as, you know, in general as well as upon request? Post it to the website, have copies of the report available in the school. I don't know exactly what the expectations are for traditional public schools, but they have to make these things available to the public, not simply classify them as public information.
Mr. Pickle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, under 13D, the school does have to have it available for the public to come in to see it. We would have no problem that if the school has a website, that it be put on the website.
Thank you.
And
thank
Mr.
you.
Chair.
Representative Pickle.
And Representative Dabney, it's also the AYP performance information is on the state website with all the other public schools.
I don't want to beat it, but it AYP doesn't include financial issues and that sort of thing. Thank you.
Well, you can certainly entertain a motion to, at some point to do that if it's true.
Is that appropriate at this time? Do you want me to work
well,
with
Well, why don't we work with staff and amendment?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson and then Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just to clarify, on page 16... and line 1628, and this is just to clarify the language that was taken out. I assume that chapters 35 or 354 and 354A designate who's going to pay the employer and employee contributions for TRA. Right now, you took out the part that specifies that, so just trying to clarify. I don't have the language in front of me.
The members were, I think Representative Peterson is referencing lines 16.29 through 16.33.
Right.
Mr. Pickle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, yes, this clarifies. The current language says that when a teacher is on leave, they would pay both the employer part and the employee part. Right. But charter schools are subject to teach TRA under 354, which is if you look on subdivision 22 on 17, mm-hmm. line 17-8, so they are required to pay for the employer part while that teacher is on a leave anyway. So this just clarifies that it's the school's responsibility, not the teacher's responsibility, to pay for the employer's part while they're on leave.
Which school? The charter school?
The charter school.
The charter school.
Representative Peterson, the charter school.
Okay, then one other...
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question, which I don't see in here, and just a question about special education. On special ed cases, do you work with directly with the state for reimbursement, et cetera, for special ed students? Or how does that work? I don't see it in here, and I really don't know how it works.
Mr. Pickle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, there is a provision in the charter contract in, what page is that? The payment is done the same way as all districts, because charter schools are a district for that purpose, and therefore they have to have a special ed director, and the costs are split federal, state, and billed back to resident districts like any other district, and the state deducts that from payments like they do for every other district.
I think the commissioner can help us with this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, the state has a uniform billing tuition system that was enacted in 2005, so we have uniform rates for billing tuition. Normally from a district to a district, the district will bill each other back using our uniform rates. The charter school is a little bit different in that the charter school does bill back the resident district, but they receive 100% reimbursement for those special education costs. When it's a district-to-district billing, it's based on the amount of revenues available, remaining revenues available, so districts will experience what's called a proration or less than 100% reimbursement from the state.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Peterson, are you?
Well,
Representative Peterson.
What, I guess I'm questioning, and I'm trying to, thank you, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to follow this through. So, when you say they get the 100%, is that from the state or from that resident, from the district, the bill back to the district?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it would be from the resident district. But the state would reimburse the resident district 100%, and then they would reimburse the charter school. That's how it works.
Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Representative Downey, and then we'll move on to our amendments.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think most of my questions actually were handled under the AYP applicability discussion there, but I do have a follow-on under on line 12.8. It talks about the commissioner being able to reduce the charter school state aid by an amount not to exceed 60%. And I'm curious, what are the provisions under 127A, 42, and 43 that would actually give the commissioner that kind of an authority? What kind of violations are we talking about? Is that AYP or is it a more egregious violation?
Representative Folsom. And Commissioner Anderson's back again.
Mr. Chair, if I could have Lisa Larson pull up the exact statute, but it's very specific. I believe it's teacher licensure violations. Oh, I have it in front of me. Violating what it is employing a teacher who does not hold a valid license. Non-compliance with mandatory rule of general applications promulgated by the commissioner and according to statute. The district's performance of a contract of rental rooms or buildings for school purposes, and talks about just generally about rental rooms, so that must have been a concern many years ago from the legislature. Any sections that violate the Establishment Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which is generally known mixing religion and state. Five is failure to reasonably provide for resident pupils school attendance, so providing services to students. Six is noncompliance with state laws prohibiting discrimination of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, or otherwise known as the Human Rights Act, which is Chapter 363. And then seven is using funds contrary to the statutory purpose of the fund.
Thank you. So not AYP violation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner, I'm curious, when the charter school enters into corrective status relative to AYP accountability, is there anything that then triggers currently in terms of the department voiding contracts, or obviously we haven't been there yet.
Yeah.
But what would state statutes and or rules tell us at this point, if we ever arrive at that point?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the state statute is silent on what the action the commissioner would take in the event that a charter school is in corrective action and needs to be restructured under No Child Left Behind. The federal law basically states that the charter school goes through the same process as a school would go, a school governed by a school district would undertake. We've had a lot of conversations with the department as to what we'll do if that happens, if we do have charter schools in corrective action and requiring restructuring, because those charter schools are under a contract and part of the contract is academic performance, and if that's not being met and the school's in corrective action, then something drastically needs to change with that school. So at this point, we haven't come forward with any proposals. We have been discussing that. Right now, only the districts of Minneapolis and St. Paul have schools that are currently in corrective action and beginning the process of restructuring. They've actually decided to move up ahead with their restructuring, which I think is good. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of learning our lessons right now from those schools as to what we'll do with schools that enter that phase when that happens.
Commissioner Brown.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one other point of clarification, I'd be happy to provide this resource to the committee under a grant from the U.S. Department of Education a couple of years ago. The department worked with a group of authorizers representing it was St. Paul School District and also from the higher ed and the nonprofit sectors, and worked with the National Association for Charter School Authorizers, and we developed guidance for authorizers on the intersection between the charter school law and doing a contract with the charter school and the AYP requirements and the corrective action, various consequences for schools that were in various levels of AYP. And again, this isn't something that was, it's not mandated under state law, but it was to provide guidance to authorizers about how to incorporate the expectations for under the AYP law into their charter school contract. So I'll be happy to provide that to the committee.
Very well. And committee members, we may want to visit that issue at some point. Very well. So we're going to move on to the amendments. And the first amendment is your amendment, Representative Slocum. Members, that's the A18 amendment. And it was just distributed. And Representative Slocum. Representative Slocum moves the A18 amendment. Oh, I'm sorry, you're not on the committee anymore. I'm so used to having you, your friendly face here from the last couple of years. I apologize.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the amendment.
I truly miss it.
Representative Abler moves the A18 amendment. Representative Slocum.
Okay.
You might as well. And members, well, I'll have the pages pass out the next five or so amendments. I just don't want to flood you with a whole bunch of amendments all at once here. Flood you?
We can certainly flood you.
Application affidavit. The first part is application affidavit. Clarification and getting language in line to be similar. I want to wait on that. Mr. Chair?
The proposed spoken.
We are still not. The language in the amendment isn't exactly the way for lines 1-114. For the fee, for the authorizers.
So, would you prefer we withdraw the amendments and then work out the
could
language
that
you want?
Could we hold this for just...
Representative Abler, would you be so kind?
I'd like to withdraw the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
You have a really good amendment.
I don't even know what's the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Stabney.
While we're waiting for pages to distribute amendments, I do have a small oral one off of our earlier conversation,
let's
if you'd like to take that.
Representative Dabney.
And thank you to Ms. Larson for helping both educate me and work out an amendment. Page 13, line 31, this is back to the issue of access by the public to the report required, the annual report required there. And it would be to strike on page 13, line 31, strike the and that exists between employees and parents. No, don't do that. Okay. Ms. Larson?
Ms. Larson, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the document 80935DE5, page 13, line 31, before the period inserts, and also must post the report on the charter school's official website.
Like she said, Mr. Chair.
Members, do you have that amendment? Let's read it back one more time.
On to
our representative.
Yeah, sorry, we've passed the papers back. Line 31, page 13, add, and also must post the report on the charter school's official website.
Members, we understand the amendment. Any discussion? Representative Slocum.
Okay, I don't have a problem with that. Is that what was just passed here?
No,
this is different.
No, this is an oral amendment.
I don't know why we couldn't just use this. It's the same. The oral amendment's fine, but this is... it takes it even further. The one that was
when you say this, you're referring to
Mr. Chair?
While
both use the word website, they are
different. Yeah, it is
different.
Yes, okay. I have no problem with that.
Protocol 1 refers to the school and the other refers to the authorizers.
The oral amendment focuses on public access to the annual report. The A8 amendment, which is mine, focuses on public access to the identity of the authorizer.
Yes.
They both use the website as a tool.
Very well. Members, are we clear? And members, it's not my desire to do a lot of oral amendments here, only if they're quite simple. And but I think this one's okay. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Which one are we doing this? Christina. So next we have the A8 amendment. Is that yours, Representative Abler? Snappy.
No,
Mr. Chair, I'm on a website roll.
You're on a website roll. At least you're on a roll. The chair is bouncing all over the place. Representative
Mr. Chair and members, one of the challenges with charter schools for the public is knowing who the authorizer is. With a traditional public school, if I've got an issue as a parent or a community member, I know that to borrow the language, the authorizer is the local school board. If I've got an issue with the charter school, I may or may not be able to determine who the authorizer is. This simply requires that the authorizer's identity be posted on the website for the school with contact information and on marketing materials so that we add a little bit more sunshine to the relationship.
Very well. Representative Slocum.
I have no problem. I think this is a great idea.
Members? Discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Yeah, we're rolling. Except I don't know what our next amendment is. I'm missing my right hand. Representative Abler, is the A9 your amendment?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Why don't you move your amendment at this point?
I'd like to move A9, Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler moves the A9 amendment.
And the point of this is one of the reasons I was hoping charter schools would do well was there'd be little laboratories to export ideas that work and cause less harm if they don't work. And this is just a way to help that information get out. It's it does say must, but along the way, I think this is something we want to have them publicize their successes. We heard from some charter schools at some of our other meetings in the interim that were just extremely successful and. That those could be exported. So this is meant to be a way to help accommodate that.
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair and Representative, my only concern is that would there be a fiscal cost for this? And I don't know that. We also deal with it in a slightly different way in the bill itself. We're finding it.
Mr. Chair, and I think this being the policy committee, it's not the fiscal committee, and if we like the idea, then it could be, if it's not objectionable, then it could be worked through. This bill has a long ways to go. The Senate has an entirely different way about this, so I think if we like the concept, then I'll work with the author to make it workable, and I don't mean for it to cost any money.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler, it is the intent, if we're successful with this bill and committee, to move it on to finance committee where those finance issues can certainly be vetted. Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I agree with the concept. I think that one of the functions of charters is to share some best practices. And there are some schools, one of which is there, is represented over in the corner over here, and they do some phenomenal things. and I really hope they can share some of their practices where they're beating the odds with student populations that we're having a really hard time even getting to AYP. We're not, we have the achievement gap that won't close and a dropout rate that's embarrassing. So if they can share best practices and we can learn from each other, including traditional districts, I think it would be fabulous.
Mr. Pickle.
Mr. Chair, in the subdivision 14 line, starts with line 1324, and in the annual report, we have added that schools have to report their innovative practices and their implementation. Five of the six purposes of charter schools are about innovation, and so this is a way we've tried to say that charter schools, for the first time, have to document it annually what they're doing in terms of innovation and its implementation.
Mr. Chair, just to keep it a placeholder, maybe if we just make it May, then it could just be carried on for discussion, and maybe it can be rolled into just be a, it's meant to be assistive and not a burden. So if I change my motion to be on line 1.5, make the must to May, and then I'll work with the author.
Well, Representative Abel, you'll incorporate that into your amendment?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
On line 1.5, to change must to May. Very well. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Peterson, the A15 amendment.
I don't have it yet. Do I?
Yeah. Members, I apologize for not having these amendments in your packets. Obviously, we should have had those all in here ahead of time, and we'll certainly do that from here on out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is pretty clear. It just it says that, you know, if a district has closed a school, and there will be more and more of that going on in districts because of declining enrollment, and in my particular district it happened this past year, and it's a very emotional happening. I mean, it closed actually three schools, and this just says that there will, if there's a charter school that is going to relocate or wants to get into the newly closed building, that they would have to go through the local school board to get permission. And I think that's probably an appropriate way. And it does say that that would happen for at least 36 months. They'd have to do that.
Representative Folsom.
I would disagree with this bill, or this amendment, excuse me, for actually a number of reasons. Number one, 1 mile radius, if you're looking at a city of Minneapolis, that would mean essentially that any new charter school would be located in southwest Minneapolis. That racially isolates, it kind of flies in the face of what a charter school is about. It also asks that any new charter school would have to locate with a traditional district school board permission. So they have their own school board, the charter does. So, and they also have a rigorous approval process through the Department of Ed and through their authorizers. To add this additional geographic, I think, is counterproductive to what charter schools are about.
Members, discussion? Representative Abney.
Question for Representative Peterson. If there was an existing charter school in the area that wished to expand grades, student numbers, would they be allowed to do that within the boundaries discussed here?
Representative Peterson.
Mr. Chair, not without permission of the with the local school board of that school district for 36 months.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, that's not what I'm seeing here is a newly chartered or relocated, but if there was an existing one under this, wouldn't they be allowed to expand
Mr. Chair and Mr. Dabney, Representative Dabney, it says they must not locate a newly chartered or relocate an existing charter school, whether they're expanding or not. It would be relocating an existing charter school, as I read it. I know we struggled with this language for a long time, and I'm hoping it says exactly what we meant it to say, and that is that the school board, the local school board, would have jurisdiction over that particular school that has been closed for 36 months, and that makes sense, because certainly there are a lot of emotions when a district has to close a school, and a lot of decisions to be made. And I can give you an example. In the district that I'm from, they've already appointed a committee of the local community members, businesses, school board, etc., to determine how they're going to use that school and how it's going to be, how they're going to proceed. And indeed, it might be that they decide to give it to, you know, or lease it or even sell it to a charter school. But this just says that the school board will have that jurisdiction for 36 months.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is a question for Representative Peterson, and you may have just partially answered it. But in my own mind, I can envision a variety of circumstances where this amendment would actually prohibit exactly, I think, what you want to have happen surrounding charter schools. So, for example, a local current public school is not, for whatever reason, meeting the needs of the local community or the neighborhood, or perhaps is failing under AYP, and we have an opportunity through a charter school to serve those kids and those families much more effectively, and now here we'd be precluding that. I am curious about the kind of emotions and other things that you experienced in these specific examples you mentioned that would be so strong that they would override the interest of those families and kids to have a school that works for them in their neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, this goes back again to the local school board to make that decision. I mean, they could certainly, the local school board could make that decision to put that school into the district. It just says that because it, the final decision here is with the school board.
Mr. Chair, and in that is the rub. The charter school board has already, an authorizer has already made the decision to go in wherever it is that they choose to go, where the population that they're going to serve is for their specific purposes and their particular bend to their program. And to add this layer, I think it diminishes what we have here in law.
Mr. Pickles.
Mr. Chair, this amendment would fundamentally change the relationship of the whole system of chartering, because basically it would say that the districts, the traditional district, is the authorizer, because they can stop any school from starting or going anyplace. The other thing is, there already is language in the law, if you look on page 114, and has been in the law since 1991, line 114. This section does not provide a means to keep a school, open a school that it would otherwise close. Applicants in these circumstances bear the burden of proving that the conversion to a charter school fulfills the purpose specified in this subdivision, independent of the school's closing. So there's a high bar for anybody who wants to start a school as a result of a school closing. Just last week, I had a call from northern Minnesota, where a rural district is closing a school that's 25 miles from town. And I said to the parents there, you will not get a charter, because your only purpose in trying to start a charter is to reopen a school that's going to be closed. And that is not acceptable as a reason. 2 years ago, I went up to Roseau, Minnesota, where they had over 100 people in this little community about 20 miles south of Roseau, where they were closing the rural school. And they had the school board there from Roseau, and I said to the folks, if you are starting this, I know you're angry at your school board because they're closing the school, but if you are starting a charter school because you are angry, that is the wrong reason for charter schools, and you will not get approved. We will not support that.
and that school never has come to being because people have to get through their anger. This is a situation where there's enormous anger when schools are closing. It's a grief process, and people reach out for everything, and 90% of the time they never follow through because it is a very hard process to get a charter and start a school. This also would go against what the federal government is recommending in terms of the Obama administration's proposal to encourage replication of charter schools, especially in areas where kids are at risk.
Mr. Senator McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm being just observing some things. It seems like we're being reactive to what's happened in some of our school districts and maybe not really setting the good public policy, and I think Mr. Piccolo brought up some of those things. It's almost the assumption that we're thinking that the local school board is the authorizer, and in a lot of cases they are not. And a school board does have a choice on who they choose to lease to. And so I think we're kind of blurring things when we talk about the same building or 1 mile within the radius of. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question I have, though, is as a representative of a rural district, we're looking at different issues of consolidation, and you brought that up as an interest that's out there. What is to stop an authorizer, though, from going up there and saying that they will start that? You know, you said that personally, that you, you know, said that this would never happen. There's a high bar that needs to be. But what is stopping an authorizer through this new way in which we allow charter schools from going into that area and saying, I will put one in?
Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. The same provision in 1.114 applies whether it's the authorizer saying it or the association saying it. I mean, they have to have a burden of, there's a burden of proof that the local people would have to meet to show that it's not because of the school closing. And that's very hard to do. Because everybody's emotions are very high at the time. Plus, there is also about an 18-month period already in the process from the time you start putting together an application by the time you can open a school. So it can never happen that a school closing, for example, this year could open this fall. The earliest they could possibly open would be the fall of 2010, and so the school would be closed for at least a year before anything happened.
Members, this is an important issue and one that no doubt will increasingly become an issue as we have diminishing enrollment, declining enrollment in our K-12 schools, and I suspect many of our school districts, in fact, may be increasingly forced into a situation of having to close schools. I know my own school district recently went through that just in the last year or so, and so I think it's important that we be very careful and deliberate as we move forward here. We obviously have two kind of big policy issues that can potentially conflict here, and that is the ability to responsibly close the school down for the sake of meeting the public's needs and being wise with the public's resources. But we also obviously have charter school legislation in our state that creates opportunities for the creation of alternative public settings. I'm wondering if someone from the department can come down and speak to the issue of how, from the department's perspective, we deal or can deal effectively in these kind of situations with these location issues, and what kind of experience the department may be having. Mr. Piccolo has referenced some existing statute that identifies apparently a high bar, and I echo your sentiments, Mr. Piccolo, that I don't think the purpose of our charter school legislation was merely to replace existing the closing of existing schools. So there's a number of issues here, and I'm wondering if the department can share some light with us on this.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner. This is certainly an issue we've struggled with over the years, where the charter school statute does state you can't just reopen a charter school in the place of a building that's been closed or a district that's been dissolved. But the problem is that we have to discern intent, that they intend to reopen the closed school, which is a pretty high threshold to try to sort out an applicant's intent when They say basically they're going to have a redesigned program. It's not going to be like the existing school, but essentially is the existing school. So that makes it very difficult for the department to disapprove an application if it meets all the requirements of the law, and we can't basically improve intent that they tend to open a closed school. I certainly sympathize with the author's amendment. I know we've struggled over this issue in trying to come up with language that works, and it's very difficult. One of the issues I do want to raise is that for a school district building that's closed, that physical building is in the possession of the school district. So a charter school can't unilaterally move into the building and say, this is mine. The school district needs to dispose of that property to the charter school. So in that situation, I know there's been somewhat of discussion of that. The district does have control over the building. This is locating in a one-mile radius of that closed school or a dissolved or consolidated district. What I might suggest is it's problematic to include relocate an existing charter school because of the underlying contract that's in place, and I think there's just a lot of legal issues to that. You may want to strike that language and just say an authorizer must not locate a newly charter school within a one-mile radius for 36 months. What the process is just for securing a facility is that the authorizer submits an application for a charter school. The department approves or disapproves that application. If we approve the application, then they begin the process of locating a facility. They do not have a facility located when they have the application approved. So if we struck that existing charter school language, a newly applicant would know then for 36 months they couldn't locate within a one-mile radius of a closed school or within the consolidated or dissolved school district. If this were to become law. But I think the underlying complication, there's an underlying complication with the existing charter schools because of the contract they have in place. And it's simply not as easy as one would think to take your charter school from point A to point B over a school year and move it into a different facility, because the facility has to be able to serve the charter school and be retrofitted to serve the school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if you take that, if it's a newly chartered, then it has to be a new school, and I understand that. But there could be, in this instance, there is an existing charter school within a fairly close proximity that could simply, would not have to go the process of a charter or whatever, could just move into the school.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, that's certainly the case, but like I said, it's very difficult to physically move from one location to another location. They wouldn't be able to move into that closed public school building. That would be up to the school district. What we find is what happens in these cases of school closures and consolidated school districts, or even a discussion of consolidation brings these issues, or coming, is that they want to create a new school. And so I think that the existing language sort of complicates the situation, because what about expansion within the school, and then we have to discern, did the student enroll into that school because of the closed school, or is it because the parent wanted that educational program? So I think if you're looking at what the problem from our perspective that we've had is just trying to discern intent around new schools replacing existing schools that have been closed, or districts that are in the process of consolidating.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, there are all kinds of things in this. The first question I have is a broad question. I don't know who to answer this to, maybe Mr. Piccolo or maybe Ms. Larson, but are there other circumstances where a school board has veto authority, should we say, over a charter school being established? I mean, other than saying, no, we don't want to authorize you and don't want to be a standard, I understand they could say no to that. But are there other circumstances under which the school board could effectively block a charter school?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demers, the only provision that current of law is if a school district sponsors a charter school and they want to locate in that school in another district, that district has to do an affirmative action against that relocate that location of the school.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in other words, if I'm a school district and I want to authorize a charter school in your school district, you would have the opportunity to say, no, you can't do that?
Yes, because it's a traditional school district.
putting a school in your district yet.
But if I, so if I want to establish a school district in my own school district, or let's say there's a charter school in my district that wants to establish, they come and ask me as the school board to authorize. I say no. They could still find other authorizers and within that district if they want to.
Representative Mariani, Representative Demmer, yes.
Okay, one more question.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have this situation going on in my district right now. We have a rural school district that has a school building closing down, and now they're exploring starting a charter school. They've been to the school board to rent the building. The school board said, no, they won't do that, and I don't know where it's going to go from here. My question is, and what got me interested is, Mr. Ficklow, you said that in that circumstances, as it happened in other places, they specifically are disallowed from putting a charter school in there and won't be authorized to do that. The question I have is, I'm trying to explore this just a little bit further, and quite frankly, want to know how far do you let a group that wants to put one together go before they're informed that you can't do it for that reason? Does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Demmer, I mean, that's really up to the authorizer to make it clear to the group. Part of the process of starting a charter school, people kind of come together and they start working on their concept and so forth. And sometime during that process, they start looking for an authorizer. So it's not like they start with an authorizer and work backwards. And so some people get it right away that, you know, it's going to be a tough hoe to make that case for it, and other people, you know, take it a long way before, and they find an author. They will find authorizers who say no. Sometimes they do find an authorizer that may say yes, but that's been rare.
Members, any further discussion? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the part of the public policy issue or question is here. If you know, as you close these buildings and districts, how many excess buildings do we want in the state, public or charter? And if we just replace the public buildings with charter schools, are we just transferring the cost of operation from the school district to the state? I was suggesting in my district, maybe the district ought to be authorizer of a charter school and simply get the lease aid and the startup costs and start a charter school magnet of some sort. It becomes, I think, a real thorny issue and will be for all of those districts that will be, as student enrollment declines and buildings are closed, we're going to be facing this in many districts. So it is an important policy issue.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Peterson, a traditional school district in law has that option to operate a charter. This is a point of information. The other, can I add one more quick thing? You were talking about empty buildings. Be careful what you wish for with this, because to have lease payment coming in, you know, empty buildings don't generate much money. And if someone's paying a lease, school buildings don't lend themselves to a lot of uses. If someone's paying a lease payment, it's income.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm supportive of what Representative Peterson's trying to do here. And I was especially interested in the Assistant Commissioner's comments that they have seen issues surrounding what I think Representative Peterson's trying to do. And so I guess I just want to point out, especially given what Representative Slocum just said, is that charter schools are supposed to be about innovation in teaching. And what we're talking about here and what we get down to with regard to the issue of school closings is about money. And what I don't want to see happening is that we're incenting with money a school district to, or a charter school to develop because a school district isn't able to afford continuing on. And as you say, buildings sitting empty, particularly school buildings, have one purpose, which makes them difficult unless they're torn down to do anything else. So I guess I'm supporting what she wants to do, and I would encourage her to continue to work with the department to find a way to make this language work. because what I don't want to see is schools closing for financial reasons, charter schools opening for financial reasons rather than innovation in academic issues. And because they're allowed to opt out of all the rules, we're making it easier for them to do it cheaper. So I want this to be about academics, not about money, and I guess I'm just supporting Representative Peterson, but it sounds like maybe some language change needs to be made in working with the department.
Representative Folsom.
Charters don't operate without rules. They operate with a different set of rules, and the rules are to inspire innovation. And a school doesn't start unless they have a purpose and philosophy. And the starting of a charter school is a rigorous and long process. And through this bill that's in front of you, we've made it more rigorous and actually longer to start a charter.
Representative Peterson, your motion is on the table. You heard a little bit of advice from the department about possible suggestions to language on relocating. I leave it to the author's will in terms of whether you want to attempt to rework that language or you want to vote on this amendment as is.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm not sure that we can retain the language to, I mean, I'm always willing to negotiate some kind of language that makes sense if this isn't clear enough. But I think the intent here is to give the local school board some time and the authority to act as they see fit regarding those buildings that they close. And it won't just be in the metro area, as you said, with consolidations all over the state. And I know that Mr. Piccolo says that the authorizers will be careful doing that, but we don't have that kind of assurance. And I just think the local school board has to have some jurisdiction. Now, they very well might say, this is fine, we're going to lease or we're going to do something with the charter schools. But this puts it in the hands of the local school board. And actually, I think that's an important piece for all of our school districts.
And Representative Peterson, your parameters include your one-mile radius and a 36-month period of time. So anything beyond 36 months then reverts back to current status quo. Members, I'd like to take a vote on this amendment. Any further comments or discussion? Representative Swift.
Mr. Chair, I am just wondering if a motion to lay on the table might be appropriate so the author could visit with stakeholders, work out language, and then bring it off the table for further discussion.
So when? So time certain?
Representative Swales, I was just trying to figure out the technical procedures. You haven't made that motion. You're inquiring, and perhaps Representative Peterson can respond to your inquiry.
We just had our own personal conversation here.
What's the sense of it?
Wasn't good. He called him. He called him. Oh,
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. I'm so busy rereading this language again. But you know, if it's laid on the table till this evening so we can have a chance to talk to all the parties involved, I'm fine with that. I don't know if we can find different language, but I'm willing to explore.
Representative Peterson, why don't you withdraw your amendment? That would be the perhaps the easiest thing to do at this point, and we can revisit it based on any further discussions that you might have. I do sense that the committee, the pros and cons of this particular amendment, and perhaps there's a place we can get to where we're not struggling as much.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dabney.
Some of us have precinct caucuses this evening, or other committees. I'm wondering what time you're planning on reconvening to facilitate as many of us being involved as possible.
It's my intent to reconvene the committee at 6 p.m. this evening. Representative Peterson, you're withdrawing your amendment?
Well, if people aren't going to be here to vote, then I'm not going to withdraw my amendment. I mean, what?
All right, very well. Members, are we ready to vote? Very well. All in favor of the Peterson Amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Obermueller. I believe you have the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment, first I move the amendment A4.
Representative Obermueller moves the A4 amendment. Representative Obermueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would adjust the provision on page 8 of the bill, or of the delete all, I guess, that would allow a contract that was entered into by the board of direct, or by the school board, to remain in place basically at the option of the school board or at the commissioner. This is in the conflict section, as you may recall. And the current law, as it's proposed anyway, would be to make that contract void rather than voidable. And the distinction is that a voidable contract, if it's advantageous to the school, can be kept in place pretty much at the option of that school board. And then if it determines in the future that the contract is no longer advantageous, even though there might be a conflict, it could then void the contract. And so I think that's the goal of this, is to try to do that. And then the second portion of this, on lines 1.6 through 1.9 of the A4 amendment, deal with a conflict with board members trying to get, I think, what the intent of the original was, that a board member can't be involved in the negotiations of the contracting if he or she has a conflict.
Representative Slocum. Well, Mr. Pickle, if I remember correctly from your previous testimony, the first part of the amendment, you were looking for stricter language, and I think in the DE5 language before us, we have stricter language. I think Representative Obermueller is creating a little bit more space there. And then on the second part of the amendment, Representative Obermueller is moving kind of more in a stricter direction in terms of including board members under the conflict of interest provision. Mr. Piccolo.
Mr. Chair, in terms of the first part, yes, we wanted a stricter standard that it's just void if there's a conflict of interest on the part of a board. I'm not sure by putting that it's void at the discretion of the board, if the board has seen a conflict, that they would necessarily void the contract. That's why we wanted it just void, period, rather than voidable. In terms of the other provisions that are being proposed in this amendment, I don't think we have any problem. The language that is in 8.7 through 8.17 is actual language from the federal rules and statutes. So to add members of board directors, I don't have any problem with it. We don't see any problem with that.
Very well. Any further discussion? Representative Obermueller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to that first portion, my goal here was to allow an individual who might be on the board, not involved in the negotiations, but be able to give an advantageous contract to the school board to be able to do so, even though that would otherwise be a conflict, the second part, you know, keeping them out of the negotiations. But the it wouldn't prevent the board later, you know, in a majority of the board overruling that individual member, keeping the great contract while it was advantageous, but avoiding the contract when it was no longer advantageous.
Very well. Representative Devlin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I like this amendment, and the reason for that, as a school board member in a public setting, you are able to participate in the open bidding process for services and for goods, even as a school board member or as an employee of the school district, as Representative Obermueller was talking about. But there is a process whereby, number one, every member of the board has to agree with it, and number two, you have to keep documentation showing it's the right thing for the school. And I would submit that if it's the right thing for the school under those sort of circumstances, when I was on the school board, we had this exact thing happen, it's in the best interest of the school district if it's the best deal for the school. Mm-hmm. And so to just arbitrarily say that that there's no opportunity for that, I think might be shutting the door into possibilities for a school district. These are adults on the board. If they all agree, and if it's documented, if it's the best deal, and if it's a closed bid process, I don't see any reason why we couldn't go ahead and leave the language as it is. And that would be adopting Representative Oldmuller's amendment, as far as I can see.
Mr. Pickle, you have something to add?
Mr. Chair, this section is about who can serve on the board. And for on 735, it starts up with an individual prohibited from serving on the board if they have any of these conflicts. And that's what this provision's always been about, is who can serve on the board, not whether or not the board can do a contract.
Members, any further discussion? If not, then all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Obermuller, the A5 amendment.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment, I think, will be non-controversial. The goal of this one is to allow, on page 4 of the document, at lines 3 through 4, to allow the commissioner to do a review of the authorizer's performance more often than every 5 years. I was concerned that the language as it's written says it shall review it every 5 years. That might be construed as not allowing the commissioner to do that formal work more often if it wanted to. And the goal here being able to say if an interested party or someone comes forward and says this authorizer needs to be reviewed, or the work or its performance needs to be reviewed, that the commissioner could do so more frequently than 5 years.
Representative Obermuller moves the A5 amendment. Representative Spokes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Obermuller, I have no problem with that.
Members, discussion? If not, all in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Slawick. The A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawick moves the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A3 amendment would delete the Charter School Advisory Council. Mr. Chair and members, I thought about this in terms of why this is needed. It seems like it was in place before, and then it apparently is being put back into place with no cost. We all know when we have advisory councils, there's at least, for the early childhood advisory councils, at least a $25,000 cost suggested. And then there's a significant change in the duties of who is on the board and what it is doing. So, Mr. Chair, I think that it needs more evaluation and really it needs to be potentially just a separate bill even. Okay.
Representative Slocum. Mr. Pickle.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slocum. This is a, we put this in our proposal, and I know it's also in the department's proposal, to refocus what that council did, because it had several duties under the old council that never were followed, and so we said if there's going to be council, it should have duties it should actually do. We are not going to, I think it would be helpful to have a council to help the process as it changes, but we are not, if the will of the committee is to eliminate it, we believe we can still get this stuff done without it.
Further discussion? Representative
Abler. Mr. Chair, if we pass this amendment, we will be deleting on page 21 the word revival and reenactment. I've never seen that in a bill, and this is our chance to carry this language forward, and that's just kind of a joke, but I never saw the word revival on a bill, so it's interesting that. So that will be lost on future committees.
Representative Flowers.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion.
Any further discussion on the motion, members? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Members, we have, I think, about a half a dozen other amendments left. It is my intention to reconvene the committee at 6 p.m., but I just want to do a very quick check here. I know we have a number of members that are not here, and a couple of members or several members have expressed difficulty with attending tonight's meeting. Obviously, it would be preferable if we're all here for that. Just, you know, 30 seconds very quick on your advice to the chair about meeting tonight. Members, we are going to increasingly be bumping up against some very tight time frames, and you can certainly count on evening meetings for the next several weeks to come, and possibly even additional meetings in addition to our 3 days a week. That's not at all unusual, partly because many of us are only now starting to get some of these bills introduced and referred to this committee. So anyway, some quick thoughts and advice from any members here? Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, I do have a committee hearing and a bill being heard in that committee this evening and will not be able to attend, but my advice to you would be to talk to some of the chairs who really have Friday morning hearings scheduled that are choosing not to meet on Friday morning and are moving it to evening if the intent of this committee is to have evening meetings. I do not want to miss them. So if you would talk to those other chairs about perhaps keeping to their assigned committee time, that would help.
The struggle among chairs. any further advice? Members, if not, then Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, just as I indicated, I have precinct caucuses in Minneapolis this evening, so would not be able to be here only for a very limited time. I would ask that you roll the bill over into tomorrow's meeting time. There's obviously a great deal of committee as well as public interest in the bill, and I think that we might get a richer discussion during a regular committee time, given the number of conflicts I know exist, personal, legislative, and other.
Thank you. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also like to just point out for not all members, but some members are in education finance, and this bill will be going to finance, and some of this, especially the financial pieces of it, can be vetted in finance.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Abler?
Just for the future, and we have to meet and get stuff done, and so the chair has a prerogative, but maybe if there's a, if you're planning on future meetings, those will be published and people will know, but we've all had days when we're in three committees at once, and that's just how it goes, and I think this is a deadline is 3 weeks away or something. So.
Representative Abel, it's good advice, although I will note that this committee hearing, in fact, has been published, and it's certainly typical for committees to recess and continue the work in the rest of the day. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think this is a really important piece of legislation, and you want as many people here to discuss it as possible. Viewpoints from all committee members. So that my advice would be to continue it tomorrow.
Members, I've listened to the advice. How is it that the speaker always says that? Listen to the advice, the check the council. And I'm going to do whatever the heck I want there anyway. That's right.
That wasn't very good advice.
Members, I am struggling with this because I do want you all here. I don't want, with all due respect to the Finance Committee, I don't want Finance Committee making policy decisions without, certainly without advice from the Policy Committee. And so I'm going to hold this bill over until tomorrow morning. We will not meet today, but please be forewarned that we will most certainly be meeting evenings for the next several weeks. And so members, Representative Fowles?
I could suggest, Mr. Chair, we maybe start earlier tomorrow morning so we can get make up for some of the time we lose tonight.
I don't think we can start earlier at 8:30 because of our posting requirements with the public, but we will certainly start right at 8:30 tomorrow morning. Members, until then, this committee stands adjourned.